Teewecker,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles and critical believers. RevLab.
Standing on the graves.
Graveyard. The vicar said it's okay.
The vicar said it's okay.
They're built like this. Yeah. I have no foundation for this, by the way, I'm just saying that. So, let's go.
Let's go. Good morning, Carla.
Good morning, Lau.
We are recording here live in the in a garden in the centre of London. It's a little park, and there's big stone walls around it on three sides. And they remind me of a church, like church walls. And there's a church tower as well behind me. But it seems to be, it's not really a church and it's not really a park. What is this, Carla? Where did you take me today?
So we're at Greyfriars Churchyard, and it's indeed both. It's a church, a derelict church, and it is also a garden, I think a little community garden. It's a garden or a little park in a church.
So inside where the church would be,
where the church pews,
where the church hall
should be, the church benches, is now allotments of garden, like little trees and bushes and plants.
And the roof is missing.
That's an important thing to mention. And luckily today is a glorious January winter day, and we have exceptionally blue sky for London. Sun is shining, so we're really lucky that it's a good day, because the roof is missing of this church. It's a church ruin. And
you can hear a bit of the traffic of busy London in the background.
Probably quite a bit, but that's where we want to take our listeners as well, in the middle of London, in a quiet little oasis in the middle of London.
So why did you take me here? What was special about this place for you?
I think one of the main reasons, probably, because I just love ruins. I have some... I have a passion for ruins. I think there's something really romantic about them, and it connects us with the history of a place. And I love to imagine how this place used to look like, or also why, what are the reasons that it just fell apart, or that it's now derelict. And it gives you also, I think, a sense of the vulnerability of life. Mm-hmm. Because this was once a church, it was actually also a monastery at the beginning, mm-hmm. full of life, people using it, people worshipping here. And now what remains are a few walls. And this place has an incredible history, went through a lot over many centuries. And I think it's just that ruins kind of trigger that side in me. That kind of emotion of, like, life is really vulnerable. And we can see that in ruined building, all kind of ruined buildings,
And at the same time, it's very lively, so we have some people who work at banks around here who take their breaks. We have the gardeners who take care of the little park, of the little allotments. We have some people who are just enjoying the sunshine.
I think it's also the kind of place you would homeless people would sometimes come to in the mornings. We saw some people who I just presume are probably without a home, who had their morning coffee here. Mm-hmm. Just a place where you can be where you don't have to buy anything. It's just a place to be, and it's quite peaceful.
That's also one of those things that's so interesting about London, is you have these complete opposites in the same places. So you have homelessness and poverty in the middle of London here, and in the same streets where these glass palaces that belong to some of the biggest banks in the world are located, all within the same sort of square mile. I think that's one thing that always struck me so much about London, is that these opposites in, like, the smallest places.
And using these the same places, sometimes when it comes together in a community place like this churchyard, which is now a community garden. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's what I like about this place as well.
So I'm sure I'm wondering, and I'm sure lots of listeners are wondering as well, why did this church lose its roof? How come about? What's the history of this ruin?
So it was, I'm actually not 100% sure when it was built, but I guess it was very important in the years already or century before the Reformation, when it was a monastery. Monasteries were places of education, of worship. It had a community, a monastic community here. And then during the Reformation, like so many other monasteries across Europe, it was dissolved as a monastery and continued as a church.
And of course the Reformation in the UK was a bit, in England was a bit different than the rest of Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course it was inspired, the Reformation in England was inspired by and also triggered by what was happening on the continent. And there were also a lot of people with Reformation ideas in England that would then influence the Reformation in Europe. But I think the main trigger for the Reformation was very top-down in the UK or in England, Great Britain. Because at the time, the king, King Henry VIII, it's probably the best-known king.
Yeah.
Everyone would have heard of him.
Yes.
The king with the many wives, he wanted to divorce his first wife, or actually annul the marriage. And that would only be possible if the Pope gave his okay, his thumb up, and he didn't do that.
So he went to ask the Pope.
He went to ask the Pope, as you do, and the Pope said, no, you can't divorce your wife.
And instead of just accepting that, what the Pope said, he decided to do something differently.
Yeah, he decided to put himself as the head of the church, so he would lead the church in the future and not the Pope anymore. And at the time, if you imagine, like before the Reformation, or during that time, predominant church in Europe was the Roman Catholic Church, and the Pope was the head of the church. So putting himself as the head of the church was split from the Roman Catholic Church, and that's how the Church of England, the Anglican Church, was born.
And that's still the same one that is here today.
Yeah, it's still the same Church of England. Dominant, the Queen is still the head of the church.
Yeah.
So it was a very kind of top-down approach, much more, whereas in continental Europe was much more grassroots movement that came from like really also changed much more in terms of, for instance, how the liturgy in church changed and like the way we worship, and a lot of things in the Reformation and the continent they changed much more. So the kind of how people worshipped when England, because it was that kind of more top-down approach and just a change of leadership, the worship life, the liturgy of the church remained quite Catholic.
Right.
It's much more diverse nowadays as well, but that's one of the differences you can see.
And the impact on the monastery was that it was dissolved, and this place where we are currently recording was turned into a church, an Anglican church. Is that right?
Yeah, and so it continued as a church, that is worship life, and then tragedy struck in 1666, which I don't know if our listeners are very familiar with that date, but in London, if you hear 1666, everyone knows what we're talking about, the Great Fire of London, where London was basically destroyed.
Burnt to the ground.
And there was no way to stop that fire. So all the foundation of the city...
Most of it was probably still built with wood, and therefore the fire would just ravage through the whole city. Including this church that was then completely burnt down.
Yeah.
So what we are seeing now, these walls are not the original, because they were burnt down in 1666, so it was rebuilt after that?
Yeah, the church was rebuilt, and a functioning church again for a few more centuries until the next tragedy struck. And the big one, I mean, there were... Of course, a lot more history going on in between. It's not like we're going forward in history quite a bit. But then in the Second World War, during the Blitzkrieg, the church was destroyed and then never rebuilt. Yeah. And it's now turned into a community garden.
So the Blitz is when the German bombers would come to England and drop their bombs all over the city. And then they hit this place. They hit the church.
Yeah. And I heard actually, you told me that you live in a house that was also...
Yes, so where I currently live is also one of those houses that was bombed and partially destroyed. So I don't live in a ruin. You'll be sad to hear, but it was then of course rebuilt. But it's funny, you can still, when you walk down my street, you can still see that all the buildings around us look the same. But then our one little part has a different color, different architectural style, and you can sort of see that's what they rebuilt, and that's why it looks different to the others on my street.
We have a couple of siblings at the Swiss church, a brother and a sister. They came here from northern Italy, and they experienced the we're just laughing because the gardener just decided to do his gardening just next to us.
But we appreciate the garden in the garden.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It wouldn't be as beautiful otherwise. Well, exactly. So bear with us. Sorry, there's a bit of gardening going on. Okay. Anyway, yeah, we have just a couple of siblings, a brother and a sister who came to London from Northern Italy. They're now over 90. She passed away, sadly, about 2 years ago. For over 90, and they came here when they, at age 8 and 10 with their mother from Northern Italy. They were French-speaking Valdensians, mm-hmm. and their mother had a Swiss friend, and right. that Swiss friend used to go to the Swiss church and took them along, mm-hmm. and they became members, non-Swiss members of mm-hmm. the Swiss church for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. They came to all the Sunday services. She came until she recently passed away. He's now too old to come to the church, but still, until recently he came along. And they, as teenagers, they experienced the war here. Actually, he was under 16, so he was
evacuated
from the city, and he lived in the countryside with other children for a while. But she was working at the time. She was the older sister. And she used to sleep in Tottenham Court Road station, one of
the underground stations yeah.
during the bombings.
Because yeah. it's one of the places that everybody who was still in the city could seek refuge in. Because they're not bunkers like in Switzerland under every building. So they used the tube stations.
It makes English people laugh when I talk to them about the bunkers.
And it is a bit silly, yeah.
The exercises we did at school, like bomb alarm, and we all had to run to the neighbor's bunker or the bunker in our house. British people find that quite hilarious. Have you ever told that? It's actually a really good story.
They find it a bit odd.
Whereas here it's very different. You have the underground stations mm. where people would seek shelter during the bombings.
Yeah.
And hundreds of people would sleep there with their taking their mattress and go back to work. I think what really fascinated me about when this church member told me the story, that she would go back to her work. I think she was just maybe in her early 20s or around 20, and she had a normal job, and then she went to work. The bomb alarm went off. She went down into the station, stayed overnight. Next day, carry on, as they say. Dust off your dress and go back to work. And it's just incredible to think that was people's life.
Yeah, that resilience as well, that you just keep going despite it all.
It's a very Londoner thing, they say.
I think you need quite a lot of resilience in order to live in this city with the busyness and everything that's going on.
I agree. I think also without that resilience, London wouldn't work the way it does.
Mm.
It's just so many people. Mm-hmm. What is it now? Nearly 10 million people living in this city.
Well, definitely more than the whole of Switzerland, that's for sure.
And I do sometimes think, it's also something that a lot of my Swiss friends also mention when they come to London, how patient people are and how quiet it is in the underground. And it's really true, like people don't talk. And you try to kind of make space for others, even if there is no space.
Yeah.
And I find that something really quite striking about, just strikes me as very special in London.
Yeah,
and also this not talking, of course you can say, people just don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
But I think it gives the whole kind of city life, and also when you go into the tube during rush hour, you have that kind of a certain calm that just makes you almost survive the situation you're in, which is being crammed in that train. It's not very pleasant.
No, I think that's right. And I think it's about, I suppose, partially also finding, making your own little pockets of peace and quiet that you need to have in order to balance out the busy life. So be it at home or in other places, or for example in this beautiful idyllic little garden that we are at currently, it really helps you balance out the rest. So I think it's really beautiful if you either make them yourself or you know of places you can go to have that. Now we have the ambulance of course.
Yeah.
Even when you're in the idyllic quiet church garden, then is the ambulance
There's
coming by.
There's always an ambulance around the corner in London. Well, we kind of knew that, but we thought we'd take the risk anyway.
Yes. Well, we want to show you the real London life, not the fake.
There's no London life without an ambulance.
Yes. So anyway, we can recommend you coming here to this little peaceful place on a sunny day. It's just behind St. Paul's Cathedral, where you find all the tourists, but you find no tourists here, even though it's just a block away.
And now I'm a bit cold because it's January.
Yeah, let's go warm up.
Let's go and warm up. I think there are a few cafes around here. And maybe we'll just take a walk around St. Paul's Cathedral, shall we?
Let's do that.
Bye.
Bye. You asked the community to send you questions that they would like to ask you. And one of them that we're going to talk about today is a really a big one. Probably the question of questions.
Yeah.
In German, you would say the Gretchenfrage. So to the heart of things, Carla, do you believe in God?
So this one is actually from my sister who asked me. Do you believe in God? And also I want to say, I received so many questions, incredible. But that one, it always catches me a bit off guard if someone asks me that. And I'm asked it many times. And it's not very straightforward for me to answer if I believe in God. But it's kind of a fair question to ask the vicar, so I'm not going to avoid it this time by asking.
Yeah, especially if you ask as a priest, if you ask us to believe in God. So you should believe in God yourself, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be very honest, the answer would be I want to believe in God. That's probably the most honest you can get. And I hope there is a God. Because sometimes I think maybe that's why I became a vicar, to talk myself into faith. and that I write sermons to convince myself that there is.
So you're not trying to convince us, but you're just trying to convince yourself, really.
I think I try to convince myself as much as anyone else.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine living in a world without a deeper meaning, without a purpose, without someone or something much bigger and wiser and more compassionate that gives everything sense. It's just really sad, the thought that there is nothing.
But it could be the case. There could be nothing.
It could be the case. You know, I have a nihilistic side in me, and I do sometimes think there is a really big chance that there is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possibly that I just find that a bit frightening, and I find that a bit sad. Because what would it leave us with? Faith for me is to have that hope or that belief that even if we are at the loneliest point in our life, our life is worth something, and we have an affirmation from something, from somewhere, from that bigger kind of compassionate, loving being.
God.
God. And for me, that's the meaning of God. And that's what I really want to believe in. And I really hope that there is a God.
So if there is a God, what does it look like? We shouldn't make an image. That's what the Bible says, but it's hard to believe in something that you don't really can't really imagine. So what would you tell us if there is a God? How does it, her, they,
look like? So it is difficult not to make an image of God, and I think that's also a bit of an illusion, because of course we have an image in our mind.
Probably all of us do.
And I think for a very long time, God has been portrayed as an old, beardy man sitting on a cloud and kind of directing every aspect of human life. By the way, it's not a bad image. I think it's just one of many images. And I think an old, friendly man can be a very good image for God. Some images that are good for some or conceived as positive can be painful for others. But I think that we can't narrow down God to one image. Because we as human beings, we have amazing brains, and we are like, evolution has done a great job, develop our mental capacity and everything. But we are limited, and our capacity is limited. And I think God is something so much bigger and beyond anything we can imagine, that any image we have is a restriction of that much, much, much bigger.
So what's your image then?
So this is one image that I really like. It's the medieval times when people imagined that the earth is a disc and that the sky is a massive globe. And the stars are little holes in that globe that points to one big light that we can never fully see. And each star is a little window to that light, and the light is God. And I think it's having all these little images. And for me, I have I have some images. One of them, for instance, is that God is like a big hand, and we can't fall any deeper than into God's hands. So we always held. That is one image I really like. I have to say, in terms of gender, I mean, you know, as a feminist, I should say, God is a woman. And I do believe that God doesn't have a gender, but I can't really completely let go of a male God, because I think it's just so ingrained in us, and it's something that is deeply ingrained in me, that if I imagine God person-like, it is, he is a man.
But isn't that just a habit? Just you've grown up hearing that God is a man, and in the Bible it's in the male gender, that's just from there, but you could change that.
I try to avoid he and she altogether. So sometimes I find ways to just not use a gender.
If I may challenge you, I'd say isn't your job as a vicar also to, you know, challenge what's been said before and try to change habits that are not founded or don't fit the 21st century? And one way of doing that would be through your sermons to actually, you know, show that God might be different genders and different forms.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, that is one of my roles, to challenge these images. And I don't know why that part of God's, I find kind of...
I do try.
Yeah. Well, these are all things I do. So, certain things that I try to change is, for instance, I don't use very often the word Lord. I do sometimes, simply for the reason that I think that for some people it's very important, so there is no reason not to use it, but I use it very little.
How do you mean? How is it important to have a Lord for somebody?
Well, as I say, I mean, people have very different images of God, and for some that title of Lord might just be for their faith, might be important, so I don't think it should be my choice as a vicar to completely exclude it. But because it's a very kind of male, and also in terms of hierarchy, very hierarchical words, I use it very little, and I do replace it with God or the internal or the source of love, the source of life. So I do play with that quite a lot. It's just about the personal pronoun that I sometimes stumble.
It's just
that one. And obviously kind of talk about the women in the Bible, talk about you know, the prophetesses in the Bible. So I do a lot of that. I also talk about that, that God has no gender, or the different, like the Holy Spirit and the Son of God as different expressions of God. And in English, it's actually very good, because you can use the word parent instead of father.
Yes, that's a very
and
good
that
one.
I do that even when I baptize children in English. I would say, I baptize you in the name of God, who is like a parent.
Right.
In the name of the Son, like Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and the Holy Spirit. And it's a shame that in German we don't have the word parent. You can say Elternteil, but it kind of doesn't really work.
Yeah, it's not really a good German word, I agree.
So the God I believe in, or I want to believe in, is the embodiment of kindness, acceptance, and forgiveness. And it does give me a great deal of comfort to believe in that, or try to believe in that. I think faith is always, everyone struggles with their faith, some more and some less. But for me, the faith in God is the source of human dignity. Because we among humans, we are limited in how much we can give each other. For me, that God is the source of our dignity, and no one can take that away.
Yeah.
And if that goes away, if that falls away, if we don't have that, then what remains? And that's why I really want to believe in God, and I really hope there is a God.
So God has sort of a backstop, if I may use this Brexit term, when humans failed.
Yeah, God is a backstop, and I think there is nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, sometimes in life you meet people you find really hard to connect with. Mm-hmm. You find sometimes even you maybe struggle to respect them even, or you find really you struggle to like them. And for me is that even if I reach my limitations, I have that faith that this person is loved, mm-hmm. and that there is a source that doesn't depend on me.
Right.
That is not in any way an excuse that I don't try,
mm-hmm.
but it gives that is a source of respect and of dignity for any person, and it doesn't depend on how I feel about that person or anyone right. feels about anyone. Yeah, and I was very political in my youth. I was mm-hmm. a very active young socialist
uh-huh.
and anti-institutional, anti-church was kind of part of that.
And now you run a church.
And now I run a church, and I was definitely never ever thinking ever in my youth that I would ever become a vicar. I mean, I'm still sometimes stop in my life and uh-huh. think, how on earth did I become a vicar? One of the most amazing things is I can go anywhere in the world, and I think also because I have my faith, my critical faith, my, you know, rooted in agnosticism faith, mm-hmm. my developing faith. I don't need to prove anything because I've thought a lot about it. So I can go into any church in the world
mm-hmm.
and I feel at home. And even if mm-hmm. it's a church where people right. believe in a very different way from me, because I'm kind of spiritually rooted.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just one big family. And in every family, you have disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
And in the church, you have massive disagreements. The theological positions can be so different. Mm-hmm. The way we imagine God, or how we imagine God's acting in the world, God's influence, or how personal or not personal God is. And that just makes church in the entire world just a home. Well, that's amazing.
With one single parent.
Yeah, with a single parent. The church is a single parent family. I think as a vicar, what I have experienced, I developed that sense of belonging to a church community, but it was a very slow process because mm-hmm. at the beginning I was like, going to a church for me was very difficult. It kind of freaked me out a bit because I didn't know what I believed, whether I believed anything altogether.
Yeah.
So it was a very slow process, and I went it at my pace, and mm-hmm. I think I always had people who supported that
mm-hmm.
in developing my faith. But what I really experienced is that how transforming church community can be.
Mm-hmm.
You come together with people from all paths of life with very different views on faith. Also some people without faith or with very critical from other religions mm-hmm. sometimes. And it's just mm-hmm. this coming together around that hope, around mm-hmm. that faith, around mm-hmm. that belief that there is something more. It's just that having that community can be so transforming. And I've mm-hmm. seen that transformation in myself.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a safety net it gives you and also in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's, for me, enough to hope that there is a God and mm-hmm. to want to believe in God.
So your answer to do you believe in God is, yes, I'd like to.
I think so.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist, Peter Yardley-Jones.